good morning. Local time is 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Bill Skinner, your host this morning, filling in for Roger Goldman. We've got 41 degrees currently in Old Town Park City, 45 in the Heber Valley, and it looks like we may finally have some winter weather on the way. Let's find out what we've got in store with ABC4's Cedric Haynes.
Happy Friday, also known as the day after Christmas, KPCW listeners. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes with a look at your forecast. As we move into the weekend, get ready for some dramatic changes. After record warmth as we made our way through most of our Christmas week, we've got some winter-like conditions heading our way as we move into the upcoming weekend. Let's talk about your forecast for you for your Friday. We're looking at high temperatures climbing right around 40 degrees in Park City. We'll be seeing those highs in the upper 40s in the Heber Valley. Look for chances of valley rain increasing as we go into the afternoon hours. In the mountains, as you get above about 7,000 feet, look for a potential of a rain-snow mix to develop as we go into your Friday afternoon. Once we get into your Friday evening, those snow levels will continue to drop, and I think most of the Wasatch back will flip over to the potential of a period of some heavier snow coming down as we go into your Friday evening and Friday night. The potential of some accumulations of 1 to 2 inches will be possible, especially as you get closer towards the Park City area. The Heber Valley could pick up a light dusting up to a half an inch as we go through out tonight into your early Saturday morning. But we're not done with the potential of accumulating snow after that. We'll start off our Saturday with scattered snow showers off and on. Some of those snow showers could give us some light accumulations in the Park City area and even in the Heber Valley, as temperatures will be in the upper 20s for your Saturday morning. High temperatures will struggle to get to freezing for your Saturday afternoon in Park City, with highs around 40 degrees in the Heber Valley. We're going to be looking at another round of moisture moving in for your Saturday afternoon and Saturday night, and that'll produce a better chance of some accumulating snow area-wide as we get into your Saturday evening and Saturday night. We could see an additional 2 to 3 inches of snowfall there in the Park City area, with the potential of 1 to 2 inches even in the Heber Valley once we get into your Saturday night. And then we're looking at snowfall totals by the time you wake up Sunday morning, potentially in that 3 to 5 inch range in the Park City area, and snowfall totals in that 1 to 3 inch range in the Heber Valley. But that's not going to be the major story. Get ready for some frigid temperatures with morning lows in the teens and single digits as we get you through the weekend. As look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back, I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, sure was nice to hear some snow in that forecast. Let's go ahead and check in, find out what that means for the backcountry. On the line from the Utah Avalanche Center this morning, I believe we have Drew. Good morning, Drew.
Hey, good morning. You know, the Grinch certainly had his day yesterday with rain to nearly all elevations. Really upwards of an inch or more of rain yesterday. And so if you're heading out into the backcountry today, you're going to find crusts of every conceivable nature, supportable, breakable, trapdoor. I think even at the lowest elevations, though, it's still wet and unsupportable. Avalanche conditions, surprisingly fairly quiet yesterday. There's just a little bit of wet sloughing out of the highest elevation northerly aspects as the rain touched some of the cold, dry snow. Today, I would really describe it best as moderate risk, very low reward. The conditions are awful in the backcountry. I think probably riding conditions at the ski areas would be fairly decent. We're groomed, but I would say we're going to just keep an overall moderate danger along the higher elevations, west to north to east, for that lingering, persistent weak layer that if you can collapse the crust and then collapse the slab, you may be able to trigger a slab 1 to 2 feet deep. But again, overall moderate, getting towards unlikely for triggerability. All eyes are on Santa bringing the cold front and upwards of maybe 10 to 18 inches of snow through the weekend. So we're looking forward to getting back to winter. So stay tuned. We'll see how things play out.
All right. Well, thank you, Drew. Yeah, let's get some snow on those mountains and get back to normal, right?
Happy holidays.
All right. Thanks. We'll talk to you next week. All right. We'll talk to you then. We'll stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the Local News Hour, Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Services spokesperson Michelle Schmidt has a rundown on new liquor laws taking effect January 1st, including one requiring anyone buying alcohol to show ID. Then Wasatch County School District's David Johnson and Amanda Edwards will talk about the school's unique GED program, and renowned ski resort map artist Rad Smith talks about painting the new Deer Valley map featuring the resort's expanded terrain. Then stay tuned for the community campfire at 9 a.m. Today they'll be reflecting on the year that was 2025, and they'll feature one of the coolest traditions in Park City called the Christmas Park City Martini Party. Also, Mitchell Elliott will highlight three of the musical artists that we brought in studio this year. They'll have that and much more on the community campfire immediately following the local news hour at 9 a.m. Well, let's go ahead and do a little bit of local news. We've got the Icon Pass Resorts are allowing skiers and boarders to skip the line with an upgrade. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports, Vail CEO Rob Katz says its resorts offer a limited version of a fast pass.
Vail Resorts and Alterra Mountain Company's Epic and Icon passes are now fixtures of North American skiing. Each costing more than $1,000, they allow individual skiers more access to more mountains, often with longer lift lines. Now, select resorts let you skip the line if you pay. Park City-based Powder Corporation introduced the Fast Tracks Pass add-on at Snowbird, Copper Mountain, Killington, and Mount Bachelor in 2021. This year, Alterra followed. It introduced the Reserve Pass add-on at Solitude, Winter Park, and other resorts in the U.S. and Canada. Vail Resorts, the owner of Park City Mountain, doesn't have an equivalent option right now, but an investor asked if one is in the offing during a recent first quarter earnings call. CEO Rob Katz says everything is always a consideration. He didn't rule it out while emphasizing Vail already offers premium experiences.
Some of the things that they're doing, you know, we have in some of our higher-end resorts, obviously, like private clubs and private dining, and then obviously, you know, ski school for us is a major driver.
For Katz, ski school is a skip-the-line pass of sorts.
We have to look at, like, how it would impact the total ecosystem and other sources of revenue and other business lines that we have.
Alterra also owns Deer Valley Resort. Spokesperson Emily Summers confirmed Deer Valley is not a part of the program, but didn't say whether the resort is considering it. Deer Valley and Vail Resorts Epic Promise Foundation are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, some laws from the 2025 Utah General Session will go into effect January 1st. That includes some new liquor laws that require those buying alcohol in Utah to show their ID, no matter what age. KPCW's Roger Goldman sat down with the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverages Services spokesperson, Michelle Schmidt, about what these changes entail.
Significant changes to Utah's alcohol beverage laws go into effect on January 1st. On the phone to help us understand what is happening is Michelle Schmidt, Director of Communications for the Utah DABS. Good morning, Michelle, and thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Michelle, the major changes, as I understand it, are the result of HB 437. What did that law require the Driver's License Division to do?
Essentially, what happens with the change in law is that starting on January 1, 2026, everyone who is purchasing alcohol in the state of Utah must be ID'd. What HB 437 does that creates that 100% ID rule is it creates a new category referred to as an interdicted person for denying the sale of alcohol.
And that term interdicted, that's a new term. What does it mean?
In this case, not getting into the definition of interdicted beyond
yes.
what I understand
yes.
as
yes.
far as how it applies to this law.
Yes.
So in this case, essentially an individual is deemed interdicted by court order, by a judge in the court of law. And a judge can make this determination if an individual is found guilty of an extreme DUI. Again, it's all at the discretion of a judge. So the judge makes that ruling, and then a person is considered to be interdicted.
And I understand now that there is some judge discretion here. What is the concept of an extreme DUI? What does that mean?
An extreme DUI is if an individual is found to have a blood alcohol level of 0.16 or higher. Also, if an individual is found to be under the influence of other illegal substances in addition to alcohol.
And just so our listeners have a frame of reference, what is the DUI limit in this state, just the regular DUI limit in terms of blood alcohol level?
Right. The blood alcohol limit in the state of Utah is a 0.05.
So a 0.16 is basically three times that level.
Yes.
Okay. I can understand why they might label that extreme. Okay, so implementing this, this means that everybody, when we go into a bar or a restaurant going on out starting in January, everyone's going to get asked for an ID. How does the ID tell the purveyor of alcohol whether someone's interdicted or not?
I understand. I struggled with saying that word for several months. I've had time to practice it. Interdicted.
Yes, ma'am.
An interdicted ID will have bold red letters above the image on the ID that says no alcohol sale. So starting in January, everyone who checks the ID, who sells alcohol in Utah, checks the ID, they need to check to see, do a visual check to see if that language is on the ID. I'll also add that because this law is effective January 1st, that in the month of January, there will be very few IDs that have this language on the ID because that's when it first starts.
Will the state of Utah, are they going to sort of reach out to the people? Are people currently interdicted, or is that only something that will happen going forward by a judge order? So it's not like there's a bunch of people who are going to get their licenses pulled and have that thing stamped on it. Have I got that right?
That's right, yes.
Okay, so it's only a prospective thing in the sense that over time there will be people who find themselves in front of a judge for a DUI kind of an issue. And at that time, and only in that time in the future, can a judge order them to be placed on this interdicted list.
Yes.
Okay. So now just so people really understand this, this means that absolutely everyone is going to be showing an ID starting in January, even old people like me.
That's right. If you're bringing your 80-year-old grandpa to the restaurant with you, or if you are an 80-year-old grandpa, bring your ID.
Okay, so
if you want to purchase an alcoholic beverage.
Are there differences in the way this is going to get implemented between bars and restaurants, or is it basically the same?
There are differences, and that is in the scanning of IDs. So right now, bear with me. I need to find this chart that I have created here for that purpose. Because there are different requirements for scanning the IDs.
Mm-hmm.
And so what will happen is at bars and taverns, currently everyone must have their ID scanned prior to entering a premise. And for restaurants, customers seating in an area that is a bar area. So mm-hmm. you can tell the difference when you walk into a restaurant, you'll see a regular seating area, or you'll see an area that looks a little bit physically different. You can see the bar there. They're making drinks in that sectioned off area. So customers sitting in the regular dining area, their IDs will not need to be electronically scanned. But customers sitting in that bar area of the restaurant, those IDs will need to be electronically scanned. So that's a key difference, and the DABS has been sending out information to those owners and managers of restaurants so they can understand that distinction.
Are they going to be able to figure out a way to make the scanner smart enough to tell whether someone's interdicted without the person having to look at it? Are the scanners going to be able to pick this up as well eventually?
So right now, we believe that some scanners are picking this up and others may not. That's why we're really encouraging folks to do that visual check on the ID itself. It's also something the legislature, when they meet back in session in January, they're going to be looking at some of these provisions of this law, revisiting some of them and seeing how they can finesse some of this language there.
And that, of course, brings up another question. As I was reading the frequently asked questions information put out by DABS, it indicated that a passport could still be used. Is that right?
That is correct. Passports, out-of-state issued IDs, and military IDs, all of those acceptable forms of ID remain acceptable in 2026.
And at this point, the legislature isn't requiring someone to consult a database. Let's say I come in with a passport. They're not requiring them to, like, get on their computer, consult a database to see if this happens to be an interdicted person.
That's right. That's okay. Right. There is no database for somebody who is checking the ID to go to. They can still perform the same identification checks that they are using now with passports moving forward.
And I'm curious, my guess is that you're getting a lot of questions from the various owners and operators of facilities that serve alcoholic beverages. Is DABS helping out with some training to help people figure this out?
Yes, definitely. We are really working hard to send information to businesses that have alcohol licensing to make them aware of this requirement. And we're continuing to work on additional educational materials. We've also reached out to organizations like in Park City, the Park City Area Restaurant Association, so that they have this information. Happy to continue having those conversations with those really important groups who get that direct face-to-face time with those folks in Utah who are going to have to start, you know, adhering to this new requirement.
Michelle, are there any other changes that to the law that will affect the sale and consumption of alcoholic beverages in Utah?
Not specific to this HB 437.
Right.
I think, for us, the main points that we really want folks to take away with is starting on January 1, if you are a customer who is going anywhere to purchase alcohol, always have your acceptable form of ID on you, regardless of your age appearance. And then to anyone who sells alcohol, if you are at a 7-Eleven, if you're at, at a 7-Eleven or a grocery store, a restaurant, anywhere, you are required to check that ID. Make sure you do that visual check on the ID. Look for that no alcohol sale above the photo. If everybody does that, then they will be in accordance to that new 100% ID law.
And have you seen a mock-up yet of what that interdicted legend looks like? Does it just say no alcohol in red, or does it say interdicted, or all the above?
It says no alcohol sale. I have seen an image of it, and we're waiting on the driver license division because it is
it is
that office that is creating the IDs and managing that from that front. So we're waiting on that to be made available on their website or by some other means. But I can tell you I had seen it, and it's very clear. Right.
That's what I was asking.
Image, it says in red, no alcohol sale.
Okay. Michelle Schmidt of the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Services, the Director of Communications and External Affairs. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, let's go ahead and check in on a couple more news items. The Telluride Ski Patrol Union has voted to strike amid stalled contract negotiations, and the resort says it will close this Saturday, December 27th. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports.
The Telluride Ski Patrol Union announced late Tuesday it would strike on Saturday, December 27th. In response, Telluride Ski and Golf said it would close the resort that day and work on a plan to safely reopen. The Telluride Times reported 99% of the union voted for the work stoppage December 23rd. Ski patrollers have been in wage and benefits negotiations with Telluride Ski and Golf for months and have been working under an expired contract since September. The union said on Instagram it's about fixing a broken wage structure and creating a pathway forward for years to come for those who strive to make the job a career. The privately owned company, also called Telski, criticized the union vote in a statement on Christmas Eve. Telski owner and real estate mogul Chuck Horning said it would have a devastating effect on the Telluride community. The union is looking for base wages of at least $28, while the company is offering about $24. Patrollers say their proposals are $112,000 apart during the first year of the three-year contract and $65,000 apart overall. The company has so far offered most patrollers at least $3 more per hour, but the union says it wants more money and, quote, understanding to be brought to the table. The party's latest bargaining session was December 22nd, where the company again presented what it said was its last, best, and final offer, which patrollers have twice rejected. In 2024, the Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association also chose December 27th as the date to begin its strike after contract negotiations stalled with Vail Resorts, owner of Park City Mountain. Park City patrollers claimed victory after a 13-day work stoppage that resulted in increased base wages. With patrollers on the picket line, Park City Mountain stayed open with reduced terrain and other operational impacts during the busy post-Christmas season. The Telluride and Park City unions have expressed support for one another, but Telluride's union president previously told KPCW that patrollers there are in a different situation because Telluride is not publicly traded. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Nearly 1,800 U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employees have left the agency in the last year under pressure from Trump administration policies meant to cut the federal workforce. The Utah News Dispatch reports that a loss of almost 20% of the service's staff. Oregon and Washington lost a combined 50 senior-level scientists and staff. California lost 40 employees, Florida lost 20, and Hawaii saw 10 senior staff depart. The losses, especially those of senior experts, could imperil species already endangered across the country. Many who left said they accepted buyouts or early retirement offers from the Trump administration. Trump officials plan to eliminate another 143 positions at the Fish and Wildlife Service. The cuts are on hold until January 30th, 2026. However, until Democrats and Republicans negotiate a health care subsidies deal ahead of a vote on a government spending package. Stay tuned. We've got more local news hour coming right up. Well, the Wasatch County School District offers a program for adults who may not have received a high school diploma to get a GED. KPCW's Roger Goldman sat down with Wasatch Alternative High School Principal Todd Johnson and Administrator Amanda Edwards to learn more about the program.
The Wasatch County School District has a GED program that doesn't just serve members of the local community. They also do an outreach into the prison population. Here to talk about the GED program, we have Todd Johnson and Amanda Edwards. Good morning, and thanks for joining me.
Good morning.
Let's start with the big picture. What is the Wasatch County GED program, and why is it important?
Our GED program is adult education and allowing any students of any age to further their education is super important because it allows them to then step into whatever else they want to do at a higher livable wage and reach the goals that they want to reach for themselves and their families.
What is a GED?
It is a general education development, is what a GED is called. General education development stands for. And it really is an assessment that shows the overall proficiency at a high school equivalent level in four different tests. So English, math, science, and social studies.
So in order to obtain a GED, I take it you go through some classroom education and then have to pass these tests?
Yes, sir. The students who participate actually work through a pretest that shows where holes in learning or gaps are. And then our adult ed instructors help students prepare to fill those gaps and meet those requirements. And then they step in to take the assessment.
It sounds as though the nature of the curriculum would vary depending on the skill set of the student as they come into the program. Am I getting that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
And then they go through it. Talk a little bit about the kind of classroom participation that they have to do to get through this.
Classroom participation is actually based on student need. Mm-hmm. We have some students who come in ready to pass any of the assessments right away. And we have other students who come in and have gaps, say, in math. And then the classroom instruction looks like our teachers filling the gaps that they have, looking at their results from their practice assessment, filling any holes, providing either individualized or small group instruction so that they are able then to feel confident going into the assessment.
This sounds kind of complicated, right? It sounds as though you guys are doing some fairly individualized sort of curriculum planning. Where do these classes take place and who coordinates all that?
It's actually through our school district supports Wasatch County Adult Education, and we serve anyone in Wasatch County or outside of the county. If they're interested, they're able to participate as well. It is coordinated through our district office, and then we have our five teachers that work in the adult ed program, work different evenings and different schedules so that we can maximize output in meeting the needs of our students.
And you mentioned evenings. Oh, go ahead, Todd, you were gonna say something.
Oh, in addition to that, I just thought you might be interested in a new way that we're using the GED this year in our district. And last year, our board passed policy around a focused graduation pathway. And so not only is the GED used for adult education, but we are also leveraging it for students in our alternative school. And so students in alternative school can work towards a high school graduation through the GED as competency. And so one thing that I really like about that is that if students demonstrate that they have proficiency in those subject areas that Amanda just told you about, we'll award credit and expedite their path to a high school graduation. And that's what the state of Utah calls focused graduation.
And just so that I can understand the distinction, a GED is sort of like a high school diploma, but you're actually talking about an actual Wasatch school district diploma.
Yeah, we're talking about using that GED to make up coursework in those core content areas, mm-hmm. which would then save student time as they are pursuing a regular Wasatch graduation diploma.
How many students do you typically serve a year in your GED program?
In adult ed, it widely varies, sure. truly. Mm-hmm. Right now, we currently have about five students working in our Spanish GED program. So we offer in Spanish as well as English. And so we've got about five working in Spanish. And then we have between, with our high school focused graduation pathway students, we have about 12 that are with the adult ed pursuing GED testing.
I want to hear about the prison GED program, which is not something that I've heard a lot about from other jurisdictions. Is this a fairly unusual program?
I wouldn't say it's unusual. I think it's happening across the state. Honestly, when we go to adult ed directors meetings, we have a lot of places that educate in our jails and prisons. So we have a teacher, her name's Kathy Carr. She's absolutely amazing. She goes out to the prison once a week and provides instruction for the students there who are wanting to finish a GED or their high school diploma through that work. And we're just lucky enough here to have a great relationship with our jail to be able to then celebrate graduations. It's been quite a fun opportunity for both Todd and I and the instructors to attend out there and celebrate our jail students who are pursuing education as well.
Now, I imagine there's some complexity here because, as I understand it, the jails population, they're in there for relatively short periods of time as opposed to sort of prisons. Mm-hmm. So how do you get it turned around? And do some of them actually continue their education after they are released with you? How does that work?
You know, they are here for relatively short periods of time. And what we really hope to do is just spark that learning mm-hmm. again and get them back, you know, get students believing in themselves. That's what education is all about, right? Getting that spark going again, helping people learn how to learn and want to continue that. As we catch students, some of them are farther along in their high school completion. So it provides a window to at least get a GED test or a couple packets done so that they are closer as they move forward. And I really honestly can't speak much to students pursuing outside of jail opportunities once they leave us. However, I do know that we've had some students who've come to us out of other jail programs, you know, or leave us to another jail program. So I would assume that those students also then continue once they are released.
So just clarification on that though, I mean, you know, when we say jail and you say a short period of time, that short period of time is not weeks or months. There are inmates that are there for years, and it gives them hope and something to work on. In fact, we just celebrated a graduation.
And do you have any sort of stories of successes where people have gone on through the GED program, gotten the diploma, and you've heard that they found a better career?
You know, we have students all the time that continue to just come back and share their success stories with us. I know that our jail graduation that we just had, she's super excited to continue as she has her release date coming and focus more on some learning in post high school work, you know, when she's released. But we also have our students who, it opens doors and just for higher levels of pay, right? They finish, they have their high school diploma or that GED equivalent. It checks that box and they're able to then pursue higher education through MTech. We have a lot of our students who then finish GED work with us and then go to MTech to make that next step.
And, you know, my sense is that there are a couple of things that are being accomplished here. One is you get the piece of paper, you get the credential, which can help you in the job force. But I sense that another thing you're trying to do is help people understand that they are capable, that they are, that they can learn.
A lot of it has to do with confidence building. And it was great to see this recent graduate, you know, she said, this is something that has been a goal for mine for a long time. And especially as her mother was there to celebrate that with her, they both, you know, they both celebrated together, and that was fun to see.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you want to add before we go?
No. Thank you so much, though, for having us on. We truly in Wasatch expect to excel, and really hope that all students and people just feel comfortable coming to us at any stage of their education to continue pursuing learning.
Right. Well, like Amanda said, the only thing that I would add is that what a blessing it is in America that you can continue to come back to education. It's never really over.
Okay. We've been speaking with Amanda Edwards and Todd Johnson of the Wasatch County School System. Thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this.
Well, have you ever wondered how ski maps at your favorite resorts are created? KPCW's Grace Dorfler sat down with the man behind Deer Valley's newest ski map, Rad Smith, to learn more about what it takes.
I'm KPCW's Grace Dorfler. Joining me today for an interview is Rad Smith. He is the map maker behind Deer Valley's new terrain map. Rad, good morning.
Good morning, Grace.
Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
I guess to get started, I would love to hear a little bit about how one becomes a ski terrain map maker. How did you find your way to this path?
You know, that's a great question, and I'll try not to run on too long here, but it's been kind of a lifelong, you know, combination of events in my life and in my career that led to it. I was always a drawer and a painter as a young person, and I studied both fine arts and commercial art in college, kind of pursuing more of a graphic design path early on, and I always loved maps. I was attracted to National Geographic maps, and I loved weather maps and things like that as a young person. And I basically started a career in more in the environmental and cultural resource consulting world here in Bozeman, Montana, and worked for a firm that had an office here but did projects all over the world. And maps were always just a big part of my work, and infographics and things like that. And I continued to pursue my interest in maps through that work that I was involved in. And I wanted to get back more to painting as I got older, and I spent so much time on the computer and was getting a little tired of staring at a monitor. And I loved to paint on my free time. And throughout my career, I had become aware of James Neuse's work and his impact in the ski industry with his maps, and realizing that one person had been responsible for the bulk of the maps that had been created, at least in my lifetime. And the more I learned about his work and became just ultimately really attracted to that style. And I was doing a lot of three-dimensional digital illustrations for my maps at the time. And like I said, I really just wanted to get away from the computer. And I knew he was contemplating retiring, and, you know, after a long career of painting hundreds and hundreds of maps throughout the world. So a number of years ago, I reached out to James and started a conversation with him, and he really encouraged me to pursue this, and that kind of led to where I'm at today.
And now, of course, you're getting a fair bit of attention for your map of the Deer Valley Expansion East Village. How long did it take you to make that map?
The painting itself took about 70 hours, but the whole process was more like 150 hours total, spread out over a number of months, 4 or 5 months total. I mean, I work on multiple projects at one time, but yeah, it's a long process that involves a lot of steps, and a lot of people were involved in helping me get the information correct, and yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of time. I hear that there's some aerial work that goes into getting ready to do the map painting. Do you go up in a plane? Do you send up a drone? What does that involve?
It kind of depends on the project. If I can get up in a plane, that's somewhat ideal. But with drone technology, I certainly rely on that a lot as well. Really, the aerial imagery is critical. You know, I certainly utilize a lot of online mapping technologies and resources for an overview, but I try to do that sparingly and utilize as much photography, aerial imagery as I can to get, you know, those details correct, and the hill shading and the tree densities and buildings, the location of buildings and roads. I mean, ultimately, I really do try to rely on the aerial imagery as much as possible. For the Deer Valley map, I did not get up in a plane, unfortunately, but I was provided hundreds of images by Deer Valley, mostly drone imagery, but a lot of ground imagery as well.
Wow. For a landscape that large, how do you even start? What are the first steps?
You know, looking at both past maps and then looking at, they provided me with a lot of site plans and kind of showing the extent of the development over a number of years and trying to figure out how that fits in with the existing ski area. And again, I'm, you know, doing a lot of, initially there is a fair bit of computer work and bringing those maps in and draping them in something similar to like Google Earth and just seeing how things fit in and trying to figure out how high of a perspective I might need to take to make sure I capture the different, you know, aspects. And it's such a large area. I certainly had to take a much higher perspective than a more traditional map, which creates its own level of challenges and, you know, items that I need to kind of overcome and in order to develop a map that is both visibly appealing but also useful, you know, as a wayfinding tool.
What's the hardest part of making a map?
You know, each step has its challenges. I think the hardest part, you know, especially a map that size, is again, making sure that you're giving credit to the runs that need to be, you know, shown in the distance, and that, you know, if they're falling kind of away from the viewer, you have to kind of bend that reality and still make it believable to the viewer. So it's something that they can identify as a place that they may know and love. So really just it's kind of like a puzzle and making sure all the pieces fit properly and that it's, you know, a believable image and making sure it's accurate.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like such a unique blend of precision with, you know, all the scientific aspects of the landscape and artistry with the painting. What was it like to learn from James Niehuis?
That's a good question. You know, really, I mean, James's work is just such a visual inspiration to me, and to have his encouragement for me to pursue this, and boy, that's hard to put, really to describe how that feels, you know, just finding, you know, having conversations with him and learning more about some of the techniques he used, and it's just so invaluable. And also the painters that predate his work and some of the other panoramic painters and trail map painters, both here in the United States and in Europe, they have a long history of mountain panoramic painters. And it's pretty amazing to be in touch with someone that has that much talent and proficiency in the painting world. And it can be a little overwhelming because he sets such a high bar with his paintings and his trail map work. And it gives me something to constantly aim for and shoot for.
Yeah. What kind of paint do you use on the maps? Are they watercolors, oils, acrylics?
They are in large part opaque watercolors or gouache. Mm-hmm. I do use an acrylic paint for the skies or some areas that I want to be more permanent that I know I can, you know, come in and paint watercolors over. And the nice thing about the gouache is it's a really fast medium to work with. It dries really fast. It really started out as an illustrator's medium, and it's very vibrant, and you can come back and blend colors, and if there are mistakes or changes down the road, it's easy to remove the paint from the illustration board and repaint areas. So it's a fairly flexible medium in that sense. You know, mostly out of respect for time, you know, it's just a fast medium to work with.
That makes sense. Do you paint things besides ski maps?
Right now, no. I would like to. I shouldn't say that. I mean, I've painted other property, you know, in that ski map style. I've painted, you know, I've had private commissions for ranches and, you know, large pieces of property. And So I would like to, you know, get back to doing more painting for myself in a similar style. I mean, I think it would still kind of fall in that same category. I love the mountains and I love painting, you know, terrain. I love, you know, the more extreme terrain, the more fun it is to paint. So, but right now I'm just so focused on the trail maps and trying to fulfill those requests and keep up with that at this time.
That sounds like you're busy. Is that your full-time job?
It is now, yes. I left the consulting community in late 2020, 2021, and I've been drawing and painting maps of, I 90% of my work is trail maps and hand-painted maps. I still do some digital work for some clients I've had for a long time, but I've slowly transitioned to almost, you know, painting full-time now.
Wow, it's a really unique career path. One thing that I wonder about is, what do you see as the value of a hand-painted map rather than, you know, like you mentioned, there's a lot of technology now like Google Earth and things like that. What does a hand-painted map offer that other ways of showing the landscape don't?
You know, first and foremost, I think it allows you to manipulate what you're looking at in the landscape to fit the needs of that mapping tool. I think it's harder to do that in the digital world, you know, with Google Earth or any kind of map information that's derived directly from real life data and it's not manipulated. Second to that, though, I think there's such a unique tradition in the ski industry and how they depict their areas. And, you know, it kind of gives a sense of there's kind of a timeless sense to hand-painted trail maps, and I think that often sits with, you know, the nostalgia that's felt at a ski area, and I think we're in this day and age, we're just so overwhelmed and bombarded with digital maps on our phones or on our computers, and they're great tools for, you know, getting around and finding, you know, where you're at and where you need to go on a road. But I think in the natural world, you know, a hand-painted map has a more organic feel, just an overall look and feel that is a lot more in line with, you know, that experience of a ski area. I mean, we ski to be out in nature and to kind of get away from that digital world nowadays. So I think it's just something that people want to look at for a longer period. And it's kind of a treasure map and makes you want to go out and explore. And I don't know that we always get that with the digital maps in this day and age.
Yeah, I hear you. Is there anything unusual about the Deer Valley map that people with close eyes should look for this winter?
Well, you know, I mean, that's, Deer Valley is such a unique place in what they've, their expansion and what they've opened up, what they will be opening up with this year. I mean, that's just a massive leap in expansion. So I think those new runs and a lot of that new terrain around the East Village in large part is kind of I think that's just what makes it unique. And it's such a large map, and to be able to see how this new terrain fits in with their existing terrain. And I don't really, you know, add any hidden items in there or anything like that, but they're, you know, I think it's just kind of an expanded treasure map that hopefully will allow people to get out there and explore all this new terrain and feel comfortable doing so.
Nice. Will you be able to come explore the terrain this winter at all?
I don't have a specific date on the calendar yet, but yes, I am planning to get down there this winter and spend some time at Deer Valley skiing.
Yeah, pick up a copy of your map.
I will, yeah. I will. And I'm planning to do another painting of that new terrain in a more traditional style. So I need to get down there and, you know, talk about that with some folks down there and get some more imagery and remind myself of how incredible that new terrain is.
Nice. How big is your painting itself that's then scaled down?
I typically paint a larger ski area like Deer Valley at 30 by 40 inches. Mm-hmm. Honestly, an area as big as Deer Valley, I could go larger, but that's kind of the largest. I paint on illustration board, and that's kind of the standard size of an illustration board. But with the amount of information and detail required in that landscape, I do wish I could, you know, I would love to paint it larger, but there are time constraints too with that.
That makes sense. Yeah. Well, Rad, thank you so much for telling me about your process of making these maps. It was great to hear about it.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate your interest in it.
We've been speaking with Rad Smith, who painted the expanded map of Deer Valley's terrain. Rad, thank you.
Thank you, Grace. I appreciate it.
Let's go ahead and get back into some local news. Summit County Councilmember Canis Hart says he'll run for re-election in 2026. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports he represents the far western Snyderville Basin.
Canis Hart is seeking a second term on the Summit County Council. The Democrat tells KPCW he has the same priorities he did 4 years ago, including stopping overdevelopment and maintaining both open space and community character. He also sees major Kimball Junction infrastructure projects coming down the pike, as well as High Valley Transit's enhanced bus service into Park City.
I'd love to stay at the helm there and keep working on these projects, as well as continuing to do the work like we did with the 910 Cattle Ranch acquisition and the Your Property acquisition. Probably one of the greatest honors was to be one of the two lead negotiators on the 910 Cattle Ranch. And I can't believe I was lucky or fortunate enough to get to do that in my first 4 years.
The council's other negotiator was Chris Robinson, who represents the other half of the Snyderville Basin in District 4. Only Hart's and Robinson's seats are on the ballot in 2026, and Robinson says he will not run for a sixth term. In previous elections, all council seats were at large, but a 2025 state law divided the county into five districts. Hart's seat is now District 5, which includes Summit Park, Jeremy Ranch, and Lower Pine Brook. Now he says he could feasibly knock on every voter's door.
When you're running a countywide campaign, you know, you do everything you can to get to all parts of the county. You certainly meet with the elected officials and leaders of each of the cities and, you know, areas. But now it's very concentrated, so it will be interesting to see because, on one hand, I'm excited because I can go talk to, knock on a lot more doors in a more focused way. And at the same time, I'm going to miss some of the conversations that I was having.
A former Marine and outdoor industry executive, Hart took a job at the Summit County Sheriff's Office this year as the Search and Rescue Operations Manager. He also served on the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission from 2014 to 2020. After that, he ran unsuccessfully for council against fellow Commissioner Melina Stevens, who's now running for clerk. Voters added Hart to the council in 2022. Candidates can file to run for Summit County office from 8 a.m. January 2nd until 5 p.m. January 8th. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Utah wildlife experts say an unseasonably warm start to winter doesn't seem to be negatively impacting the state's wildlife populations. KUER reports winter usually signals the annual migrations for many wildlife species. Experts have seen some changes in animal behaviors, but overall, Utah's wildlife is faring well. Faith Heaton Jolly of the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources says a big reason for that is access to food. Migrating waterfowl are staying longer at the Great Salt Lake and fattening up before flying south. She says in a normal year, cold temperatures would have limited their access to food. The lack of the annual hard freeze is also benefiting some Utah bears. Jolly says the division tracks more than 30 bears via GPS, and at least four of those have delayed hibernation. According to Utah State University wildland professor David Stoner, food can be so scarce in hard winters that more animals die from starvation. He says such winters can also drive an increase in more animal deaths from vehicle collisions. Dense snowpacks hamper mammal migration and force animals to lower elevations, meaning they are more often around roads. And alcohol and drug vape use are decreasing among students in Summit and Wasatch counties. KPCW's Christine Weller reports this follows a statewide trend.
Utah's health leaders had good news to report this year. According to the 2025 Student Health and Risk Prevention Survey, students statewide are making healthier choices and feeling more connected to their families and schools. The SHARP survey is administered every other year. It's an opportunity for 6th, 8th, 10th, and 12th graders statewide to voice their readiness to face issues like tobacco use, underage drinking, school safety, bullying, and mental health. According to the 2025 results, Summit County students reported lower rates of alcohol, marijuana, vape, and prescription drug use. Almost 21% of Summit County students reported they tried alcohol at least once, an almost 24% decrease from 2023. There was also a 42% decrease in reported marijuana use, with almost 10% of students saying they've tried it. Summit County students had an almost 37% decrease in vaping since 2023 for marijuana or tobacco, with almost 10% reporting they had vaped before. Wasatch County students also saw decreases in substance use. In 2025, over 3% reported they had tried marijuana, an almost 63% decrease over the last 2 years. And there was an almost 64% decrease in vaping, with 3.5% of students saying they'd vaped before. However, more Wasatch students reported drinking alcohol than in 2023. Almost 10% in 2025 said they'd had a drink, a 10% increase from the previous survey. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, we do want to thank you for tuning in this morning to the Local News Hour. I'm Bill Skinner. I've been sitting in for Roger Goldman this morning. You're listening to KPCW Park City.